Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio with me, Matilda Hay. And this week, we're bringing you a Brexit special. Yes, what a historic week it has been. Here in the UK, we've had more political drama than a House of Cards series. The Brexit of our country, the cam lapse of our Prime Minister, the corbel state of our opposition, and an electorate divided. There's even a March for Europe happening today just around the corner, so if you want to get involved, head on down to Hyde Park. It's all happening here. So, what does all this political chaos mean for science? The UK has long been seen as a world leader in science research, attracting the brightest brains from all over the world and pioneering fantastic innovations such as the World Wide Web, the first IVF baby, or the recent discovery of graphene, to name but a random few. But now, there are fears that Brexit could affect our funding, collaborations, and maybe even cause a brain drain. Joining us today to help unpick these possibilities is author and prize-winning science journalist Munkeet Louie, who has written several articles on this very subject. Munkeet is the commissioning editor of Mosaic, the Wellcome Trust's long-form science publication, and co-author of the popular book Big Questions in Science, The Quest to Solve the Great Unknowns. Good morning, Munkeet.
Good morning.
I have to say, that title seems very apt, even just today. I mean, we're attempting to solve the great unknowns of Brexit.
Indeed, and it's going to go on for quite a long time, I feel, unfortunately.
So as well as Brexit, we'll be hearing all about what life as a commissioning editor is like, Munkeet's top big three science questions, and why a helium shortage could ruin more than just your birthday party. On top of that, our weekly experiment takes a slightly new form this week with producers Yaz's EU crazy game. This is a simple true or false of some of the weird and wonderful laws from Brussels. All you need to join in is access to Twitter so you can play along too and tweet us your answers. And as always, we want to hear from you. Your brain teaser this week, bit of a riddle, and it goes like this. What comes once in a minute, twice in a moment, and never in a thousand years? If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Soho Radio with the hashtag Science Mixtape. And just tweet us your opinions on Brexit in general. And no, the answer to that riddle is not Brexit. Well, that's quite enough from me. It's probably the longest introduction I've ever done. Munkeet, this is your mixtape. So what song are we kicking off with and why?
So we're kicking off with I Won't Let You Down by OK Go, which is, although they're an American band, the reason I really like this song is that it's got a kick-ass video filmed in Japan and with a cameo by one of my favourite Japanese groups, Perfume, at the very beginning. If you have a spare moment, I'd encourage you to seek it out on YouTube. And it's just a really nice kick-ass song.
Yeah, we'll give that video a tweet. Here we go.
Maybe all you need is someone. Maybe all you need is someone to trust. Maybe all you need is someone. I won't let you down. No, I won't let you down. I won't let you down, my love. I won't let you down. No, I won't let you down. I won't let you down, my love. No, I.
Collectively, the EU remains the world leader in terms of its global share of science researchers, with over 22% of researchers.
That's ahead of China and the US. And you've said yourself in one of your articles, Munkeet, that Britain is ranked as one of the top five in the world for science and number two for the most cited research. So I wanted to start by asking you, what do you think it is that currently makes us so great at science?
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons. A lot of it stems from historically. You know, science started out particularly, you know, in the last few centuries as something pursued by kind of gentlemen scientists, people who had the time.
Yeah, it was like a leisurely activity. If you didn't work, you thought, not thank.
Exactly, and that led to many of the discoveries that that have made modern society what it is. So there's that kind of history and prestige aspect of it, but also, I mean, its position where it is in the same, for exactly the same reasons as it's big in business. You know, its position here with you know, albeit on the other side of the Atlantic, relative proximity to the to America, its proximity to Europe, it's kind of placed as a hub for people to come through, and I think as well just its general the way that it punches above its weight, because for a long time people have said that we don't invest enough in science and innovation, and actually, you know, the UK government only puts in about 1.6%, I think it is, of its GDP, of the UK GDP, into science and innovation. So it's incredible the kind of the amount of scientific output in terms of papers. Some of the reason it ranks in the top five is because of its it's among the top five of most cited research, the most important research that people are constantly referring to throughout the world. The UK has a very large proportion of that, second only, I think, to the US. So the fact that it does all this on really quite a little input is remarkable.
Yeah, it's something to definitely be really proud of. And in the run-up to the referendum, it was interesting because basically every university, every scientific institution and famous scientists, they all came out so strongly in favour of Remain. I think one of the reasons that everyone's so shocked is that it's like science itself would have predicted we remained, because you've got the status quo bias, mm-hmm. which seems to have a big effect when referendums are close. The status quo bias is our implicit desire to keep what we are used to. And it's been shown time and again by behavioural psychologists to play out in loads of situations, from whether you change your electricity supply to things like the Scottish referendum. Like, it did work in the Scottish referendum. So I think a lot of people were shocked that we actually, the result was against the status quo bias and what science would have predicted might have happened. But what do we think is going to be the result of Brexit for UK science? Because there's been a lot of talk about how it's going to affect our funding and collaborations.
So, I mean, there's the thing with everything to do with Brexit at the moment, which, as you said at the very beginning, it's just uncertainty. Nobody really knows, particularly in the last week since we seem to have lost our entire government and and our shadow cabinet as well. So nobody really knows who's going to be in charge, yet alone who's going to be doing the negotiations, yet alone what the result of any negotiations are.
But it's true that we are going to lose a lot of funding if we leave the EU, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we get about, I think, £1 billion a year from the EU in funding terms, and that's like 10% of the UK's entire spend on science, which, as I say, we put very little of our GDP into science as it is. So the fact that we're able to produce as much as we do of, you know, really world-class stuff that people read, that people take note of, is remarkable. So losing that is going to be a problem. I mean, it's important to say at this point that, as I say, with the uncertainty and the no deals in place and certainly no government, nobody really knows what's going to happen, and nothing's going to happen in the immediate sense. Everything pretty much stays the same, probably for at least a couple of years, in funding terms. There's a lot, the grants that are out there, some of them are multi-year grants, some of them lasting as many as 10 years. So nothing will change in those respects. And I think, you know, the UK scientists are very respected. They're very, very close colleagues with a lot of European institutions who will be fighting their corner to keep them involved. So I don't think they'll be kicked out any time soon. The danger which comes, though, is, as you say, the kind of the free movement of people between institutions, and also what that means in terms of collaborations, whether people will pull out.
Because I think already, aren't there fears that because of the uncertainty, other people are thinking, actually, we don't want to renew a grant with Britain because we have no idea what they're going to be doing in 5 years' time. And we're actually already starting to maybe see or feel some effects of people not wanting to collaborate in an uncertain world.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of anecdotally, there have been tweets and so on, people saying that they've heard of certain institutions maybe or collaborations that are kind of putting things on hold or having second thoughts about inviting Britain into negotiations or collaborations or anything. There's no clear evidence yet. So the science minister, Joe Johnson, Boris Johnson's brother, ironically, he said that he's asked to set up a kind of an open file for people to please come forward if anything like that happens, so that he can collect data and then make an argument. And he's already spoken with the EU science minister, I believe, to kind of forewarn and kind of try and prevent any of that happening. But it does become difficult because it is human nature, as people have said. You know, if you're looking at a country with an economy that might be going back into recession, that you know, when we may not know what the outcome of negotiations will be for a couple of years.
Harder to attract the sort of brightest and best from around Europe if the UK is not, yeah, a place of a thriving economy.
Exactly. And I mean, on top of that as well, you know, there's some deals. I mean, like with the European Space Agency, for example, which is not part of the EU, but they, a lot of the projects that are on there, if part of it is funded through EU funding, you can't then invite people to tender for contracts from countries outside of the EU. So that would automatically rule Britain out of a lot of the satellite projects, for example, that it's involved
and
in.
And that wasn't that the funding that allowed us to put Tim Peake into space?
Yes and no. Tim Peake actually got there on pretty much on his own accord. We actually don't do much in human spaceflight. At least we didn't until 2012. And Tim Peake applied and got on in like 2009 intake, I think. So
I thought it was with the ESA.
He went with the ESA, but it kind of his application and kind of getting onto the ESA had nothing to do with English funding, okay, really, to some extent. And but I mean, he's kind of kick-started the way that we put a lot more. We put many millions into space research, and we started the UK Space Agency in 2010. I wouldn't say directly as a result of Tim Peake, but certainly, I mean, him being a bit of a shock of being, oh my God, why is there a British astronaut there? Despite the fact that, you know, a lot of UK experts say that human spaceflight, and it's a bit of a waste of money, we prefer robotic missions. him getting on was actually, I think, a bit of a shock to a lot of people in 2009. So he's, all credit to him, you know, we've got a big UK space industry now. Kind of, he's helped a bit kind of with that. And obviously there's a lot of awareness and interest in space now. The danger, I guess, is, especially with Brexit, is that although that won't prevent anybody from becoming an astronaut for the ESA, it will have a dent to the UK space industry, which put many billions into the economy, in which the government was actually hoping to grow into a £40 billion economy by 2030. I think that's probably been put on hold, and at least for a few years. And I think, we'll see what happens post-Brexit.
And I think what a lot of people might not realise is that as a science researcher, you tend to have quite short-term contracts of only 2 or 3 years. So you're right, like 2 or 3 years, it's probably not going to change. But if your contract is based on funding and grants, then in 2 or 3 years, I think that's when it's really going to tell whether we start to see a real difference in the way science is being done in the UK. But I think, do you not think that sometimes people think of science as being quite separate to the rest of the world and almost unaffected by, you know, politics? How could that affect, you know, this sort of the great objective world of science? But it really does. And I think that's something that I didn't really appreciate till I was at university and looking back at the history of science, and how actually it's not about the discoveries of some great man. It's how all these different political and social dynamics played into it. And we're at the cusp of a new one.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the fact that science is part of culture, it's part of society, that's something I think which has come out more strongly certainly in the media and in world thinking over the last maybe 20 years, 15 years, something like that. But it's still, as you say, a lot of people still think of it as a hard thing, something that's in an ivory tower. And I mean, and this showed up in some ways in the Brexit vote. What a lot of scientists have been saying is they're kind of worried about the kind of rejection of expertise, of experts.
Oh yes, Michael Gove has a lot to answer for with his comment.
Exactly. You know, he famously made the comment that, you know, I think people have had enough of experts, and the fact that 52% of the population voted to leave kind of shows that's in some ways true. So there have been editorials in, you know, The New Scientist and Nature and other places talking about exactly this problem. Where does this leave academics and experts and scientists in terms of, you know, are they taking part in society? Are they being seen as something that's other, something that's, you know, what do you know? You may have, you know, all these numbers and facts, but I either don't understand what that means, or I don't believe you because you have a kind of an agenda of your own. So it shows that there's still a lot more to be done in terms of scientists and experts coming out and trying to level with people, you know, speak to people on a more grounded level, which, as I say, I think people have got better at that over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, but perhaps it's been an explosion of science communication as its kind of own field.
Look at like Professor Brian Cox and, you know, even programs like, you know, Big Bang Theory. There's a lot more scientists in the kind of the popular culture than you would have had, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But at the same time, it's kind of what are people actually, do people feel confident enough to kind of talk and debate about science or even economics or anything like that? And then for then the experts, the kind of people to kind of in the supposed ivory towers in the universities and so on, to kind of come out and try and explain and talk about their point of view. Also from a human perspective, I think there's a kind of objectiveness about science and academia which comes from that, you know, that we have to be speaking from hard facts that speak for themselves, and not from a human level. But what I think came out of the referendum vote was that a lot of people, partly because of the complicatedness of the situation, but also because it was almost like a cry against a lot of things that people have been frustrated about and felt they weren't listened to about, like, immigration for a very long time. So I think it's kind of, it shows how much, you know, just speaking to people on a very human level, talking to people as and talking from your own point of view as a human being really makes a difference. And I think maybe that's something
it's a really nice example of an emotional vote, right? Like, you've got all these facts in front of you, but in the end I think a lot of people felt it's too complicated and they just kind of went with their gut.
Hmm.
And that is actually a nice parallel with science, because, like we said, a lot of people think science is very objective and you're very rational, but so much of the time in your research, the way the decisions that you make or the ideas that you have are going to be influenced by the way you're feeling about things.
Hmm. Exactly. And I think, you know, it's to kind of almost dismiss that, and not all scientists like this, and particularly and not to be age discriminatory about it, but, you know, a lot of younger scientists are very good at communication. They're much more open, they're much more talking on a human level. But I think still, particularly those in positions of authority, there is that feeling. And I think that some of this came out in the Remain campaign, you know, the fact, here are the facts, you'd be silly to kind of throw this away, but people kind of rejected that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something about talking to people from positions of authority being able to talk on a human level to people, and I think that's something that academics and scientists are going
to
be
need to keep working towards.
Yeah,
because on that point, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, he's a sort of very well respected scientist, said that UK science will not thrive unless free movement continues in any of the prospects it deals. And he's actually been kind of cautioned by the head of the Wellcome Trust that mm-hmm. you sort of work for, Professor Jeremy Farrar, saying, no, UK science will not thrive unless it has the support of wider society.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the most interesting points I've read in the sort of post-Brexit science analysis, is we need the support of our country to be interested, to get the funding. But on a more positive note, scientists are very good at dealing with uncertainty. That's what you're doing, isn't
Indeed.
It? You're researching the edges of our knowledge and working ways to solve problems that no one has solved before. So if anyone can survive, hopefully it's the scientists of the UK.
Indeed.
On to your second song. I believe it's Don't Falter by Mint Royale featuring Lauren Laverne. Why have you picked this one?
So Lauren Laverne's one of my favourite radio DJs.
I agree. I used to listen to her when I was 16, like presenting XFM Breakfast Show. I love her.
Yeah, exactly. She's amazing. And she actually lives not far from where I live in Muswell Hill. I haven't run into her yet, but who knows? One day, maybe. And yeah, this is just a real kind of 90s gem. I used to love this when I was in school. And I just wanted to drag it out from the archives so that more people are aware of it.
And to remind people not to falter.
Exactly.
In the face of uncertainty.
Exactly.
And stay tuned, because after this song, we will be going into producer Yaz's EU Crazy game.
Contributed nearly $4.3 billion for EU research projects from 2007 to 2013, but received nearly $7 billion back over the same period.
Yeah, UK's basically been winning the EU science lottery for a while.
Exactly, which is all the more worrying when it's now that it's pulled out, what's it going to be able to get back?
Exactly. Right, so I'm really excited about this.
I have had
very little input into all I did was come up with a name of the EU crazy.
I think that's the main bit. That's really fantastic. EU crazy.
So Yaz, would you like to tell our listeners what this game involves?
Okay, so I'm sure everyone's heard from time to time, even before Brexit kicked off, all of these news stories about these crazy laws from Brussels.
And you've actually lived in Brussels, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've seen firsthand these crazy laws in motion being passed. And some are true and some are completely made up. And it is almost impossible to distinguish which ones are the absolutely crazy. How have 20 people sat in a room for 3 months coming up with this idea? And the ones that are just completely made up and sold to the tabloids. So... yeah, I'm going to
ask
you some questions. Well, just little true, false facts, and we'll see how you do.
Bring it on.
Some of you definitely would have heard before, and some, I think, are a little bit unknown. So let's see how you go. Should we do the first one?
I'm ready, yes.
And
okay. If you're listening at home, you can tweet us in at Soho Radio as well.
Please do. Okay, so the first one is one I'm absolutely sure you've heard before. The EU law about bananas not being too bendy. Is that a true law or is that completely made up?
I think that's true.
Yeah, I think it's true too.
Yeah, you're right. That is genuinely true. But it was repaired in 2008. So it is no longer.
So we can have bendy bananas
now. Yeah. Well, it's irrelevant now. So.
Exactly.
2 to 3 years, you'll have the bendiest bananas you like.
Yeah, the only reason I've actually heard of that one is because it's because Boris and the Leave campaign sort of used it as a spearheading.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like that poster boy of crazy EU laws.
Well, it was taken out in 2008 precisely because of the fear that it was people just throwing away good bananas for being too bendy. But it all came in as part of a long list of laws about the regulation of selling sizes of fruit and vegetables. So you can't legally sell, you know, a tiny pepper or enormous cucumber as the same sort of thing. You have to regulate the sizes for quantity reasons and weight.
That's why I buy the Tesco Value
mixed bag
of strange, small and shaped
and they repealed it precisely because things were getting thrown away.
Global waste.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay, so number two. The EU says that you cannot legally say that water hydrates you on bottled water bottles.
Oh my God.
That sounds so strange. It's got to be true.
I'm always going to say, I've never seen it written on a water bottle. So if it is true, people are following it. I'm also going to go for true.
Yeah, and the internet is right as well. You're all right. True.
Well done, listeners.
Yeah, this is really one that I think people get annoyed about because it, on the face of it, is so weird. And even looking into it is still kind of weird. But
where has that even come from?
A bottled water manufacturer wanted to put that water is hydrating on their bottled water. And I think what the crux of it was is that they didn't want to imply that it was only bottled water that hydrated you. So tap water is also equally hydrating. And as with the banana thing, there's this umbrella that kind of sweeps everything out underneath it and it looks ridiculous and it is kind of ridiculous. But
hope that people realise bottled water was as good as tap water at hydrating.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think you should have more faith in people's knowledge of water.
Wow.
So yeah, that's another one.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Other people, they don't know that coffee hydrates you as well, and there's still people thinking that coffee dehydrates you.
Yeah,
but that's because coffee makes you pee, so it may give you water, but then you lose it really quickly.
Yeah, it's true.
I would argue it's not that hydrating.
I don't know, speak to the EU.
Studies say that it's hydrating.
Ooh.
Okay, number three. The popular snack Bombay Mix is going to have to change its name to Mumbai Mix.
False.
Yes, it's completely false. That was totally made up and sold to the tabloids. The Sun reported it in 2006, but it was honestly someone just made it up. There has never been a discussion.
I can't believe they actually reported that.
Yeah.
What journalist
has
actually
anyway?
Believed that that's, well, I guess political correctness if they've changed their name.
Well,
that
was the contention that it was to be, to distance the colonial past, but it's just literally never been a topic of conversation at any meeting on any level.
I'm very
glad.
Yeah, I can't imagine the EU would kind of care about that.
No, I don't think that's an EU remit either. No.
Although they do
defeating colonialism.
They do protect a lot of our kind of trade because of the way that it protects
trade terms. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that actually brings us on super good to another question. So turnips cannot be labelled Swedes except in one place, which is in Cornwall.
That's false.
That's true.
Oh, really?
That's true.
I hadn't answered, but I was going to say true.
It just seems so random. No, it's absolutely true because turnips and Swede, the term in this is kind of used interchangeably, but the EU have said that one thing is one and the other thing is another, apart from in Cornwall where you include them in Cornish pasties, mm-hmm. and then you're allowed to call them a Swede. But
if it's in a Cornish pasty, you can call it a Swede.
And you're in Cornwall. But apart from that, no. It's like a champagne, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Protecting the
area. So it's like a regional thing, so you have to kind of protect it. The EU is very big on regional terms
I guess,
and stuff like that.
That's good in a way, because otherwise you could just homogenise the whole place.
I think that's the thing. I think that's what they're trying to sort of stop it seeming like they're trying to homogenise the whole place. They're very big on tiny languages and minority
and
dialects.
Wales keeping its language as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like exactly. Gaelic and all of those things. Yeah. Like proper.
That's keeping our sausages and our pies. It's Mulberry
pies. Melton Mowbray pork pies. Very protected term. Can only be made in Mulberry.
But wow, I'd love to be there when they were debating the Swede turnip.
Well, in a few years, we'll be able to. We'll have like sausages our from own. Everywhere in our Wyoming called the Swedes all we want. Oh,
yeah. Take back control. Turnip is a turnip, even if you're in Cornwall.
Yeah, people are pretty outraged about the why can't water hydrate you? I'm seeing on the internet. I can understand it. So, should we do one last one?
So, yeah, it's currently 4-3.
Yes. So, one last one, a decider or an equaliser, I guess.
Equaliser.
So, barmaids cannot show cleavage when serving customers.
I feel like that must be false because I've seen a lot of cleavage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel it must be false as well.
Well, yeah, it is false, but it is just a misunderstanding of a misinterpretation of a law which was about people working outside and having to cover up in the sun, while employers making sure that employees working outside for long periods of time had to cover up in the sun. And that was kind of seized upon and transformed into no one can wear a top that's going to show any cleavage.
Was this the Sun or the Daily Mail again?
I think it was, yeah. It's always a deliberate misunderstanding, I think. But I guess it would mean that if you were covering up in the sun, but it's absolutely nothing to do with that directly.
Good.
I don't think that's I don't think that's something that even the EU is interested in poking its nose in. So,
and to be honest, I don't think we can be on our high horse, because wasn't there a story a few weeks or months ago about a secretary being sent home because she wouldn't wear heels?
Yeah, no, that
was horrendous.
Crazy, yeah.
Not EU at all. That just happened in the UK.
Yeah, that's absolutely a thing that happens. You can have a policy for your employers to wear a certain uniform, and that can extend to being forced to wear high heels.
Really? Wow, we can have our crazy laws even without the
EU. Keep our own British crazy laws.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for that, Producer Yaz.
No problem.
It was so enlightening. Why is this not sounding? Oh, wait, hang on, I have my trumpet sound effect. There we go. Woohoo. on with your third song choice, Mongeet. You have chosen to play Too Young by Phoenix.
Yes. So this is a song that features in the film Lost in Translation by Sofia Coppola, or Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson wandering around Tokyo being lost, basically.
I'm sensing a bit of a love of Japan. Tell me about that.
I am, yeah. So I've got a kind of personal obsession with all things Japanese culture.
When did this start?
Well, stemming from when I was a kid, really into games, Super Nintendo, anime, that kind of stuff. And then since then, it's just kind of grown. So I love Japanese films. I study Japanese. My wife's Japanese. Hello, Yuki, my darling. If
Shout
you're listening.
Out.
And yeah, so I love Japanese pop music. It's a really big part of my life. And this film and this song in particular, I remember when I was in my 20s, kind of coming out of university, not really sure what to kind of do just after that. But at the same time, still being kind of obsessed with Japan. And I think it kind of really captures the film captures the culture shock of what it's like to be in a completely different place, but also the kind of listlessness and confusion of not really knowing where your life goes. But this song, I thought it was also a nice ode to the 75% of 18 to 24 year olds who voted to remain in the EU and sadly were overruled by the older generations.
Absolutely. This is Too Young by Phoenix.
That made my life what it is. Can't you hear it calling? Ooh. Everybody's shaking. Ooh. Tonight everything is over. I'm too young.
British universities employ about 30,000 scientists from EU countries.
Well, from one big unknown to some others, I want to ask you about your recent book, Big Questions in Science, The Quest to Solve the Great Unknowns. What was the inspiration for writing that?
So I wrote that with two friends, Colin Stewart and Hayley Birch. And we kind of just wanted to... There are so many questions in science. Science is all about questions. You know, even if you think back to terms like blue skies research, the stuff that we found about lasers and so on has come just because someone thought about why is the sky blue, and from that,
yeah. I mean, so many I guess things. Curiosity is the impending drive behind most science research. It's like, why is that way? We want to know. We want to know the answer.
Exactly. And then we went to the publisher and said we want to compile the kind of what are the top 20 questions that science has yet to answer and that people are kind of dying to know.
Can you give us an idea of what those were?
So some of my favourite ones are, so can we live forever? Although in a post-Brexit world, would you want to? Although no, Boris Johnson as Prime Minister at least.
So something like can you live forever, what kind of conclusion did you come to, or did you not? You just kind of put a few arguments out.
So I mean, there's some really interesting points that came out about that and what's currently known in the world of aging research. Really interesting that comes out, things that come out of it is how weird now, well, medicine has got to the stage where some people think that if you can just keep riding the crest of the wave, adding an extra 20 years by, you know, living healthily and implementing the latest medical science, you could probably live long enough for the next medical innovation to kind of come out, and the next medical innovation, and from that you just keep adding and adding and adding, and so you can essentially reach immortality through that way. Whether that's really achievable or not remains to be seen, yeah. But I mean, we are already, I mean, part of the overpopulation problem, which is another question in the book, is that people are living longer than ever before. Other things that come out interesting from that is that, you know, we're now looking at aging not so much as an inevitable thing in life, but actually
more as a disease that can be cured. Yeah, we actually had a guest do a whole show about aging, and the thing that really amazed me, I'd never heard of biological immortality and the fact that a lobster, actually, if nothing kills it, will not die.
Yeah.
So listeners, if any of you are interested in aging, go check that one out on iTunes. What would be another one of these questions?
So another of my favorites is what is consciousness?
That is a fascinating question.
Yeah, and it's fascinating partly because you can break it down in so many different ways, right? Because it's and that's why what makes it so hard. On the one hand, there's the philosophical aspects, you know, Thomas Nagel and others have kind of posed the question, you know, how do you know what it's like to be a bat or anything? How do you know how can you possibly know what is consciousness and what is not if we don't know what it's like to be anything else? And that makes things hard. On the other hand, you know, there's the kind of more sciencey, more kind of things you can actually probe, like what's the difference between sleep and awake, people in vegetative state or in locked-in syndrome, or even down to animals, you know, you can say...
Yeah, I actually, when I was at university, we did some work on animals and whether they had episodic memory, which rather than like a sort of knowledge that you acquire, like is the ability to conjure up a memory of a specific event. And they think it's the same system that then allows us to imagine things in the future. And there's an argument that if you could prove animals have these abilities, then that's a big argument that they're more have more consciousness in the way that we see it.
Mm.
But it's just impossible to measure because we can't communicate with animals, and that's the way that we know that we're...
Yeah.
That's the only way we know what's going on in each other's heads, is we tell each other.
Exactly. It comes back to that subjective question, right? You know, mm. we don't know what it's like to be a bear. I don't know what it's like to be you. You don't know what it's like to me. It's really, so how can you possibly know what is conscious and what's not? So there's all kinds of really interesting aspects that come out of that. But I mean, we're gradually learning more. Like, we know that consciousness, it's not in one part of the brain. It's actually a kind of a phenomenon of the network of neurons in the brain, the kind of the ghost in the machine type of idea, which comes up in science fiction a lot. So, and then you go into like artificial intelligence as well. You know, can we create consciousness? Can we learn more about consciousness by trying to create it? And is that conscious? You know, if you've got something that's basically following an algorithm, is that different to us? Is it the same of us? You know, at what point do you say that something is sentient and conscious? And so the fact that we can't really define consciousness makes it really difficult to
answer. So, I guess, yeah. If you can't define the question, that's like that famous Hitchhiker's thing. It's like, the answer is 42, but what is the question?
Yeah, exactly. Let's go and think about that for 500 years.
And your final of your top three big questions.
So, I mean, it's kind of a less sexy one, but I think people have been hearing more and more about it, certainly over the last few years, is, can we beat bacteria? Which is all about the fact that there's a huge rise in antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's dubbed the 21st century apocalypse.
So, yeah.
And it's true. If you imagine not being able to take any medication and people start dying from things like that we haven't died from in over 100 years.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, the antibiotic revolution in the, well, starting with Alexander Fleming when he discovered penicillin. In 1928, the way that has allowed us to do even things like surgery, you know, we would not be able to do surgery without antibiotics, simply because you'd just die of the infections that would result from bacteria coming into your body.
So much of our medicine relies on surgery at the moment.
Like, yeah.
It's crazy.
Exactly. So that in itself is terrifying. The fact that, you know, you've got a lot of healthcare systems all over the world that are just barely keeping up, or not even keeping up, if you then suddenly use antibiotics. And there's a lot of kind of multi-drug resistant and totally drug resistant bacteria that are emerging around the world. That's terrifying for countries like India, with huge populations, China as well, Africa also is kind of worried about this. So it's not just a worry for the whole world, and with everything being more global as well, it's so much easier for bacteria and resistant bacteria to travel and swap genes, develop resistance, and there's a lot of misuse of antibiotics as well. You know, 80% of the
this tends to be like the main problem, is that people overprescribe it because it's like, oh, we're not quite sure what's wrong with you, let's give you some antibiotics.
Yes.
And then people not finishing their course, so the bacteria don't properly die, and then that's how the resistance spreads. It's really interesting. I almost think there's a lot of things that we're facing at the moment that seem to all come down to kind of behaviour almost. So I went to see Sir Mark Wolpert speak a few years ago. He was the government's chief scientific advisor.
Ex-director of the Wellcome Trust.
Yeah. Ooh, I didn't know that. And he was talking about climate change, but he then sort of went on and said, like, actually, one of the most important areas of research now is behavioural psychology and looking at human behaviour and how we can influence it, because faced with climate change, faced with antibiotics like apocalypse, we need to be able to collectively change how we behave, or we're never going to fix it.
Mm.
And I thought about that just as much when I was thinking about Brexit. It's like, everyone voted for the things that were affecting them, but none of us thought about how will Britain leaving the EU affect Europe and the rest of the world. You know, you've got straight away articles being like Putin rubbing his hands in glee at the collapse of, you know, the West. Well, that's a bit extreme, but yeah.
Yeah, and people kind of, we saw with Brexit, I think we said a lot of it was an emotional vote. There's a kind of anarchic streak, particularly in the UK, you know, you think of the punk movement and kind of stuff like that. There are instances of, you know, Britain just kind of, screw the status quo, we're going to do something different. And I think, you know, the people react badly to the kind of, Malcolm Gladwell wrote famously about the kind of nudge effect, you know, and there was the government at one point was looking into a nudge unit, you know, to see what could we learn from behavioral psychology. And people don't like the idea of being controlled.
No, or like subliminal messaging and stuff.
Exactly. So it's an interesting and also a kind of like dangerous, but also
I think he meant it in terms of just, you know, what helps people to to behave like in an overt way, not like mm-hmm. a subconscious way.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. How can you
kind of persuade people or, inspire them? I suppose
yeah.
is a better way to
and
think
it comes
about
back
it.
To kind of you know talking to people on an everyday level. You know, being able to understand more about what it is that influences people's decisions, I think helps that. Especially with, as we said before, with experts who think that if we just present the cold hard facts, people will come to the right conclusions themselves. I think no, there's a lot of it. A lot of human nature relies on stories and narratives and what it means for us in our story.
Mm.
You know, so I think the more we can understand of that, really.
And we're going to come on more to the importance of stories and narratives later in the show. But now for your fourth song, you've chosen "Fake It" by Perfume.
Why? Yes. So Perfume is my all-time favourite group. They're an electropop dance unit out of Japan, Hiroshima.
Unsurprisingly.
So partly this title speaks to a lot of the post-Brexit world and a lot of what's happened in the last week in our politics. But also this song is just a really top dance number, as you'll see from the beginning. It just reminds me of 3,000 people in Shepherd's Bush literally jumping meters in the air as a result of them coming over for the first time. So lots of good memories with this one.
British universities receive about £1 billion, amounting to 10% of their research funds, from the EU each year.
And now, for the science news that is not Brexit related.
News!
Some good news! Researchers say they have found the first clear evidence that the thinning in the ozone layer above Antarctica is starting to heal.
Researchers say that some compounds in marijuana may prevent Alzheimer's disease.
And they found a gigantic, potentially new gas field in Tanzania, which they hope will solve a crisis which has been brewing for about 15, 20 years.
Gene editing could destroy herpes viruses living dormant inside of you.
And in Iceland, a test project has discovered that volcanic rock can quickly turn carbon dioxide into stone. Lots of positive stories right there. Monkey, I'm going to jump on your helium one. Mm-hmm. And tell me more about this. Why is there a helium crisis?
So partly, a lot of people don't realise that helium is quite vital to a lot of different things. We don't just use it for party balloons. We use it for, it's a great coolant. So we use it in everything from MRI scanners to the Large Hadron Collider. It's quite vital for a lot of scientific research. It's vital for a lot of use in everything from missiles to welding, all kinds of different industries. But we've got a finite amount of it because it's a natural resource. It's formed from the radioactive decay of rocks.
We can't make it ourselves.
Yes. No.
So strange. I was going to pick up on this story as well this morning, but because it's something I'm terrified about. As soon as I heard about it, I was like, this is actually really big. Why are we talking about it?
If the scanners stop working and stuff.
Exactly. And the reason, and it's a really interesting history, the reason why it's kind of, we're almost maybe a bit blasé about it, is that in 96, the US, who have the biggest helium reserves in the world, decided that actually, because of the way that they'd been stockpiling the helium, they'd been, you know, things like airships and stuff like that hadn't really worked out. The price of helium at that time wasn't really recovering their costs. So they passed an act to say that we want to sell it off, and we're going to sell it off independent of market price. We just need to sell off this amount every year. And as a result of that, the price of helium just crashed, and it became this really cheap commodity and not the kind of precious resource that it really
that it
is.
Should be. It's like gaseous gold.
But things have changed. They kind of passed new laws in like the 2010, 2013 to try and help to solve this, extend the life of the US National Helium Reserve. But, you know, the fact is that we've still got finite resources. So this find in Tanzania, which is the interesting thing is that we've actually gone looking for it. Previously, we'd only ever mined helium where it was accidentally found potentially it's pretty huge. But on the other hand, you know, even that by itself, with we use like 8 billion cubic feet a year globally of helium, and you know, the use of helium has been going up and up, so we could burn through this stuff in like, you know, 40 years.
Oh god, like that. So the good news still has hint of apocalypse on the end.
Yeah, so you still need to look at alternatives and recycling and stuff, and look for new sources as well.
Just before we come to the end, I'm going to give everyone a few more minutes with our brain teaser. So, as we said at the top of the show, it's a bit of a riddle this week. What comes once a minute, once, sorry, I'm going to start that again. What comes once in a minute, twice in a moment, but never in a thousand years? You've got 2 more minutes to tweet us your answer at Soho Radio. And Minky, finally, in our last section, I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about your role as a commissioning editor for Mosaic. I mean, that sounds fascinating. So your job is to choose which stories get published, essentially. And how do you do that? What's a typical day? What are you looking for in those stories?
So, I mean, we get a lot of... So Mosaic is a what we call long-form publication. So we do, you know, science features, things that last at 3,000 words upwards. I think the longest one was like 12,000 words, stuff that takes you like half an hour to read, which is quite long. But we look for story. It's story above everything else, because what the reason why we set up Mosaic was that people respond to stories more than data. You know, you can give people a fact sheet, but they're not necessarily going to take it. It's not necessarily going to be of interest. What really people react to is, as I say, the human stories, human level. What does it mean for people? Is there a beginning, a middle, and an end? And then what's the wider context of it? So, for example, to use an aging example, you know, we told a story about what was happening in aging research, but we told it through the lens of these girls who have a very rare syndrome called Syndrome X, where they could be 20 years old, but they look about 20 months old because of they have decelerated aging.
That's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So I mean, that
yeah,
kind of thing,
I can see already. I'm so interested in the story, and like you said, then I would be reading about aging research. And are there any challenges? Do you find it hard to choose between stories? Or
I think that part of it is there's a lot of temptation to go for topic no story stuff. You know, you kind of, oh, I really want to do something on sleep, but if there's no story to kind of hang it around, it's quite hard to kind of do that. And I think just, you know, information overload. There's a lot of news around nowadays. There's a lot of really fascinating scientific research that's going around, and like I say, then try and coalesce that into an idea, keep up with what's going on, do what's relevant, do what's what people are interested in. I mean, there's a lot of trends, you know, zeitgeist. People are really into, for example, gene editing in science now. Is that something you want to bring to the audience, or is that pretty much well covered by what's already done in the excellent science news and science blogs and the mainstream media? What can you add to the conversation by
doing half context? Of it's kind of like finding your own stories, and half is just kind of monitoring what everyone else is doing to make sure that you're being unique and providing something for your audience that no one else
exactly.
is providing.
Exactly. And as I say, what can be done in a 3,000 word story that you can't do in a 300 word story?
True. Wow, fascinating. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but we are coming to the end of our show. So, producer Yaz, before we reveal the answer to the brain teaser, have we had any tweet in?
We have, but nobody's got it right, unfortunately, or no one's really had an answer. It's a little bit of a difficult one. I guess it's like it's always not what you're thinking about the way that's structured. So what is the answer?
So I have to confess I didn't get it either, but I do love it. It sounds all kind of epic and dramatic. And the answer is just that there's one M in a minute, there are 2 M's in a moment, and there are M's in 1,000 years. So there you go, listeners.
That's great.
That's one to do on all your friends. Mankeet, because I have got distracted speaking to you and it's so wonderful and interesting, we actually only have time for one more song. So on your list, you had Haley by Texas and Astro Boy by the Far East Mentioned Mannequins. Which would you like to play out on?
Let's go for Astro Boy. It's a science show after all. It seems appropriate. And, you know, these are two girls that style themselves, electropop unit again, but style themselves as robots from the future, come to deliver an electropop message to the world. So why not? It's available here in the UK too. So
brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us.